I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash. We're building bridges.
Definitely not walls.
I am delighted to have with us Nolan Hamilton, the Dickinsonian phrase, you know, the best of times and the worst of times. In some ways, the worst of times for organized labor as the numbers of organized entities continue to shrink. In some ways, the best of times because there's the youth energy and almost rejuvenation in organizing. Why the hell do we still need unions? I want to go back to the hammer, power inequality, and the struggle for the soul of labor, which seems so appropriate now. How do you characterize within that kind of best of time or the worst of time? What is the state of the labor movement as you see it at this juncture?
It partly depends on kind of what time frame you're looking at. If you're looking at organized labor for the entire 20th and 21st century, there's still no way around the fact that union density is, you know, down to 10%, the lowest that has been in many, many decades, from a peak of, you know, 35% or so in the middle of the 20th century. And that sort of long-term trend of the decline of unions in America is not something that we collectively have figured out how to solve just yet. We are in a specific time when there's a lot of energy, enthusiasm, and promise within the labor movement, and more than we've seen in many years. And part of that, of course, is the national political environment is friendlier for organized labor than it has been in many years. Joe Biden has been a pretty historically pro-union president. His appointments at the NLRB and at the FTC, you know, have made the federal government itself more friendly to organized labor than we've seen certainly in my lifetime. And so, you know, the ground is fertile for the labor movement today. And coming out of the pandemic, millions of Americans had that kind of radicalizing experience of the pandemic of really living the fact that they didn't have a safety net and coming to the conclusion that they needed what organized labor has to offer. And so the enthusiasm in the public is there for organized labor. And I just saw a poll today that confirmed that, you know, the public approval of labor unions is something like 70% today, which is as high as it's been since the 1960s. And so you have, in historical terms at least, a really pro-union federal government. You have a really enthusiastic general public in terms of what they think about labor unions. And so then it really rests on the shoulders of the labor movement itself to say, we're going to take advantage of this moment that we have, and we're going to plant the seeds in this fertile soil that are going to grow and become the revival of unions in America. And that is something that, although you see it in spots, you see great unions doing great things, and you see great campaigns, you haven't really seen the breadth of it, the numbers of it, to turn around that decline that we've seen. So really, I think the test for the labor movement remains, can they take that generalized enthusiasm and take advantage of it and actually organize workers on the scale of millions of workers, which is what we should really be talking about.
To what extent do you really feel that there has been any push from, certainly from the Congress or indeed the administration, to really push for something that overall advances what has been killing the organizing possibilities in many ways of labor, or certainly roadblocking it? And that is the advocacy in the legislative and legal arena for passing pro-labor legislation.
Labor law in America is horrible. It's extremely anti-union, and it is one of the biggest things that holds back the expansion of organized labor. And one of the biggest things that's driven the decline of organized labor is how hard our structure of labor law is. It's almost designed since the Taft-Hartley Act to squelch the power of labor rather than to facilitate it. And so the PRO Act is the Labor Law Reform Act that would change that, would truly be a game changer for unions. It was the AFL-CIO's biggest legislative priority during the Biden administration. And, you know, Biden would say that he supported the PRO Act, as would most, you know, the vast majority of Democrats in Congress. The problem is, you know, the Democrats did have a trifecta the first 2 years of Biden. They did not pass the PRO Act. And the fact is, like, The PRO Act is something that is never going to pass as long as the filibuster exists. Part of, you know, getting around this is the Democratic Party coming to the conclusion that getting rid of the filibuster is part and parcel of supporting the labor movement. You know, there is zero chance that the PRO Act will ever pass as long as the filibuster exists, you know, unless Democrats get a number of seats in Congress that they're never going to get. The labor movement has to start putting that as a test to the people, the politicians that say they support labor and the politicians that say they support the PRO Act.
Do you think the labor movement as a whole, certainly the AFL-CIO, there's been complete quiescence. There may be speechifying from time to time. One wanted that million worker march to say, my goodness, we have galloping proto-fascism on the horizon. We have one of the most virulent anti-labor groupings. And yet there's organizing in the South and people are trying to break through those right to work. Where are we as a labor movement in really trying to advocate as a whole for the interests of the working class? And
one of the biggest themes of my book, I think, is sort of being disappointed in the AFL-CIO, and organized labor itself is not that organized, right? The labor, you know, we talk about the labor movement, and yet we don't see a movement that really has the ability to coordinate on a national scale and have a visionary leader of this movement. I really think that the way that the AFL-CIO has behaved in relation to the Biden administration has not been that encouraging. In the head, you know, Biden did legitimate things that were pro-union, which were good, you know, but the AFL's response to that was not to continue to push him harder, but instead to be like, we're going to endorse him 18 months early. We're going to give him everything he wants. We are going to be the last organization in America defending him when everybody else is saying he needs to drop out. They sort of have made themselves into an adjunct of the White House, which is not the way that a social movement needs to progress. And of course, you know, it kind of goes without saying, they also have not been able to conceptualize these big, you know, actions and national strategies that the movement needs. You know, when we talk about something like, hey, let's organize Amazon, that's obviously has to be a national coordinated multi-union, multi-year campaign with its own funding, you know, and that's the sort of thing that the AFL-CIO should and could put together, but never seems to. You know, you do see great labor leaders out there. You see Sean Fain and people like that, Sarah Nelson, who I write about in my book, doing the things that you would hope a labor movement leader would do. It's just sort of a question of whether those people are going to be able to scale up and kind of be infectious to the whole labor movement and make the labor movement like them rather than the opposite.
Is there any possibility that the labor movement can do this as a labor movement by itself? Does it need to get on the ground and joining forces on different parts of the community sphere? Yeah.
The civil rights sphere.
Civil rights and the...
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be a need for the labor movement to be plugged into not just communities, but those other social movements that, you know, are tackling kind of the big problem of inequality and, you know, negative manifestations of class war. Things that the labor movement tackles in one way, that the civil rights world tackles in a slightly different way, that the women's rights movement tackles in a different way, and so on and so on. The labor movement is always going to have to be allied and plugged into those bigger movements. And it's, you know, it's interesting because one of the sort of most exciting demands that you saw coming out of the labor movement this past year was when Sean Fain started talking about a general strike in 2028. And started talking about unions aligning their contracts, you know, to actually be able to pull off a general strike in 2028. A lot of the discussion around that has been on this exact topic. You know, it's not simply a matter of unions trying to line up their contract dates. It's also looking at every city and every community and saying, how do we pull in these allies in each city, in each state, in each area, to make that a really impactful action? They did it in Minneapolis in a sort of citywide general strike. They spent many, many years doing the work of building a community coalition to make that action really powerful and extend beyond just union members. And so that's something that the labor movement is going to have to do on a national scale over the next 3 years if that 2028 general strike is going to come off.
The first Labor Day, that conjuncture of that intersectionality of both business unionism, of course, about wages and hours, but there was a political understanding of unions as a stepping stone, as a foundational part for the assumption of working class power, which certainly seems to have fallen away in terms of the demands of notwithstanding issues of internal democracy and unions and so on, which is still a struggle to go through. But I'm interested in your thoughts about whether or not we are beginning to move back away from straight business unionism to political unionism, and in terms of the issues of power and inequality, that our unions are there, the organizations of the working class, worker centers as well, to really assume the control over labor and the wealth that the working class create. Your thoughts on that?
One thing that you did see in the past year that's been encouraging on that front has been the labor reaction to what's going on in Gaza. Not, you know, something that was an important issue to members of certain unions that became an organizing issue within the broader world of organized labor and became a coalition, and then culminated most recently in the letter from a number of unions asking the White House to cut off arms to Israel, which was interesting because it wasn't just the usual suspect unions, right? It wasn't just UE and a few little, like, you know, smaller, naturally radical unions doing this. This was big unions. This was NEA, the biggest union in America, SEIU, UAW. And so, you know, that to me was really an encouraging moment, because the fact that you can get unions that are that big and that disparate to come together on an issue that is really a controversial issue, but a meaningful issue, you know, and an issue that sits outside of what business unionists would say is the purpose of a union. You know, that's a great example of an issue where people who just think unions are for the workplace will say, well, that's not something we should spend our time on. But the fact that that came together, I think, is an encouraging sign on exactly what you're talking about, which is taking that energy that's been going into the labor movement in recent years and magnifying it out into the wider political world.
One of your chapters, chapter three, actually, in your book, which dealt with the South and organizing. And we've certainly seen the auto unions doing work in the South, and to Amazon workers trying to unionize there. If you could relate some of your findings that went into your chapter about organizing in the South and breaking through the right to work laws and that which has been in place and really hasn't had a tremendous momentum since really the civil rights movement, which many people may not realize, but the civil rights movement definitely encompassed within it a workers' rights sensitivity and understanding, that conjuncture maybe that Ken was talking about labor and community, labor and civil rights. So talk a little bit about the work in the South.
The South has always been a problem for the labor movement. You know, the South is the poorest part of the country. The South is the part of the country where working people have the least power. And that's something that you can trace in a direct straight line, straight back to slavery and straight back up to today, and see that for the entire time, the sort of power structure of the South has existed to minimize the power of working people. It went through slavery, it went through Reconstruction, went through segregation, went through Jim Crow. Today, the entire South is right to work, and it is a region where the political leaders of that region use as a selling point the fact that they have low-wage labor and powerless labor as a way to attract business to themselves. So it's really like a lowest common denominator formula for economic development is something you see throughout the South, you know, and it's kind of a sick formula, but it's a real thing. And in my book, I wrote a chapter about South Carolina, because South Carolina is the state with the lowest union density of any state in America. and looked at sort of what the labor movement looks like in a state like that and how powerless it is. But to varying degrees, the exact same thing is true in every single state throughout the South, which is that the whole political power structure is very, very hostile to organized labor. And, you know, the labor movement's known about this for a century. And you think of Operation Dixie was the famous attempt to organize the South back in the 40s and after World War II. And the CIO's big project, and you know, people who are labor movement nerds are still talking about Operation Dixie today because you know we look and the same exact problem is in place. So obviously, Operation Dixie didn't succeed in organizing the South, but at least it was a concerted effort from the union world to be like, hey, the South is a serious problem and we need to tackle it. Big systemic problem that we need a national coordinated action and a long-term funding stream and a long-term campaign to tackle the task of organizing the South and building union power from almost the ground up in most Southern states, something that needs to be coordinated on a national level, which we don't see at all, which is another kind of discouraging thing when you think about the need there. But yeah, probably the brightest light of what's happening in terms of organizing the South right now is UAW announcing that they were going to go down south and organize 150,000 non-union auto workers. That was like the kind of ambition that we need to see from major unions saying we are going into this hostile area to organize these places. And we're not doing it because it's not hard. We're doing it because it is hard, because we understand that if we don't organize the South in particular, it's always going to be a drain on the whole union. And so we, again, just need to see that kind of ambition replicated throughout the entire labor movement, you know, or people will be having the same conversation 50 years from now.
You mentioned mobilizations, especially in the South, but throughout the country. Could you talk a little bit about some of these specific mobilizations and how it proceeds on different issues in terms of migration, in terms of women's rights, in terms of African-American rights, and so on and so forth?
If you look at some of the biggest, most high-profile union campaigns of the last few years, you know, if you look at the Amazon union drive that began in Bessemer, Alabama, it's not just random that that happened. You know, that's a town that is full of exploited, you know, largely Black workforce that were being taken advantage of by this sort of huge multinational monster of a corporation with a business model designed to marginalize the power of the workforce, you know, and that is something that is not just a labor issue. It's a civil rights issue. It's a racism issue. It's an issue of the division of political power in the South and nationally. You know, if you look at the Starbucks campaign, that's a campaign that spread from one store in Buffalo, New York, to hundreds of stores all across America. And while there were a lot of people working on it, it spread, you know, in large part from the power of its own ideas. And that was, you know, you had a workforce that could see that they were working for a huge multinational corporation, were exploited, were being taken advantage of, and could understand how a union could help them. One thing that you see today in large part on the politics side is that you see a Republican Party that is trying to strike a pose of being pro-labor. And to the Republicans, being pro-labor mostly means, in my experience, being anti-immigration. And when you start talking to these Republicans who say that they are, you know, pro-labor or pro-working class Republicans, what you find is that very fast, they're not talking about the PRO Act. They're not talking about worker rights. They're talking about immigration and sealing off the border and things like that. You know, and so I think the smart people in the labor movement, when they push back about against that, you know, are saying, look, working class people in America have more in common with these immigrants coming across the border who are working people who, in fact, are coming to try to make a better life and try to support themselves than they have with senators in Washington, D.C. or CEOs of corporations, you know. So all these issues are related, and always the labor movement has to be conscious of that. There's a lot of issues that cause people, working people, to do things like vote for the Republican Party. Look, the Teamsters endorsed Ronald Reagan in 1980, and Ronald Reagan set us on a path for the worst inequality crisis and anti-labor crisis that we've seen in 100 years. And so people make mistakes politically, and even unions make mistakes politically. What, you know, working people need to think about is, if you're in a union, read your union contract and be like, do you want this stuff? If you want it, do not vote for a Republican, because Republicans, for the most part, are existentially anti-union, and they are going to appoint people to the NLRB who will make it harder to organize unions and will make it harder to maintain unions. Look at the state of Florida. Ron DeSantis passed a law. Unions have to recertify themselves every year with this really onerous paperwork requirements. Already in 1 year, tens of thousands of workers in Florida have had their unions decertified by the state, and now you don't have a union contract. And so next year, when you get worse health care and when your kid can't get braces, people can relate it to their own lives. I don't think these are people who are trying to materially hurt you as a working person. We on the left are hurt by the fact that union density is so low, because it's one thing to say this to people who have a union contract, but only 10% of workers in America have a union contract. So to everybody else, this is sort of an abstract conversation. So again, like, raising up that union density and organizing millions of workers is a path to, I think, getting us out of this sort of trap that the Republican Party is using.
Your thoughts really about, in terms of your book to begin with, Power and Inequality and the Struggle for the Soul of Labor. I mean, how do you apply that title and that aspiration to where we are?
One thing that I'd like people to take from my book, and you know, something for us all to reflect on, is like, the labor movement is for everybody. The labor movement is for every working person. Every working person is a part of labor. And we who consider ourselves a part of the labor movement have to understand that our responsibility is for every worker. And right now we got 10%, you know, and that should be such a motivating fact for all of us. You know, that should give all of us such a sense of urgency when you walk down the street and look at all the stores and say, how many of the people in these stores have a union? You know, if you drive down the street and look at all the businesses on both sides and ask yourself, how many of these people have a union? In most places, the answer is none, or almost none. And the only people who are going to change that is us. The only people who are going to spread unions to all the workers that need them are those of us who are already in the labor movement. You know, so I think it's an opportunity for us to reflect on the responsibility that we have, and to hold ourselves to the standard of giving all the workers in America the union that they deserve. There is no tooth fairy that's going to swoop in and magically give unions to all the workers that need them. You know, we have to do that work. So I hope that that's something that those of us in the labor movement can reflect on. And for people who are not in the labor movement, never a better time to join. That's something for you to think about.
Do you see great hope also in the worker centers that have formed? You know, we have a wonderful worker center down in Mississippi in the Delta, which people like Jeribo Hill are doing incredible work with. We have the National Day Labor Organizing Association with people like Cal Soto, and the laundry worker centers that have been in the, it seems to me, and of course, largely, they're immigrant workers who have not nearly been supported. When somebody threatens to put people in Japanese style concentration camps as a precursor to deportation, and why the entire organized labor movement is not going crazy, but allows itself to be baited and split by that. Ugh. Xenophobia, we got a lot of work to do on these things, and racism. But do you see also the efforts that come from the immigrant workers organizations as also a tremendously exciting and encouraging and democratic feature to add to creating labor organization to represent the political aspirations and economic needs of the working class?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as you said, there's tons of great worker centers out there doing incredible work in the areas where unions don't exist for the most part, or reach in parts of the workforce that unions don't exist. And all of them, you know, are doing incredible work. I've written about some of them. And I'm always so impressed.
Do you want to pick one in particular that really moved you?
Well, you know, a great worker center I profiled once was Satool, which is in Minneapolis, and really just such impressive organizing of largely immigrant parts of the workforce, workers who work for subcontractors, you know, who are the most exploited part of the workforce, you know, and that's a worker center that not only organized the workers, but built political power within the city of Minneapolis to help get laws passed to raise their wages, and also, you know, in many cases was able to funnel those workers eventually into unions. So, you know, one of the, as great as worker centers are, one of the reasons they need to exist is because it's hard in America for many workers to have access to unions. So I think our long-term big vision is a union for everybody. You know, and part of passing the PRO Act and all those other things about changing labor law is to get to a world where we don't have to have worker centers because everybody could have a union.
Yeah, one of the things that's nice, we had just finished speaking with Brandon Monsilla, who is the director of Region 9A of the UAW and is organizing in Puerto Rico. And one of the things that's happening there is they are actually directly, and they must, because that's part of the nature of colonization and the tyranny of the junta that rules the island, the fiscal junta. But they've actually had to confront the junta, the very structure, in terms of their organizing and in order to get a contract. So they are some really promising signs and some vibrant people that are on the horizon, some leadership and mostly the rank and file, and community sectors that are saying, Amazon, labor community effort jointly, nationally. And with your information and your education, and with people reading books like The Hammer, Power, Inequality, and The Struggle for the Soul of Labor, I do believe we will win.
Me too. And with people like you informing everybody. So I appreciate
it. Any final word?
Just look, I would say, you know, I've never been as inspired as I am when I write about and learn about the labor movement. You know, it's the most inspirational place you'll ever be. So even when we talk about all these problems we have in the big picture, you know, talking to the people in the labor movement is probably the most inspiring and exciting thing that you can do. So everybody get involved. It's great.
Thank you for taking the time to be with us. And we really need to be with you more frequently. You're terrific.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate your work also.
Yeah, Luta Continua, and Workers of the World Unite.